Hey everyone, Ellie here. Up Against the Mob is my new cafe podcast. We're pleased to offer this exclusive bonus just for Cafe Insiders with me in conversation with my co-host from the Third Degree podcast, Safina Mechlai.
Welcome back to the second bonus episode of Up Against the Mob with Ellie Honig. My name is Safina Mechlai, and we're here with Ellie reflecting back on the second episode of Up Against the Mob, in which Ellie interviews Murray Richman. Hi, Ellie.
Hey, Safina. So I hope this was a good education for you, hearing what it really is like to be a defense lawyer from the great Murray Richman.
It was so awesome. And for those listeners who don't remember this from Third Degree, Ellie knows that my dream job is to be a criminal defense lawyer. So it was so cool to hear from Murray about what his life is like. And it sounded a little glamorous at points.
I'm trying to think of what your equivalent might be of the incident where he ends up going out to drinks with Sinatra. Would that be like you going out to drinks with like Halsey or somebody?
Yeah, Halsey's good. You clearly have young kids. How about Cardi B, somebody in the Bronx? Like that would be great.
Yeah, I thought Halsey was a solid reference. I'm a fan. We'll see if you can top Murray and Sinatra someday.
Yeah, I hope so. But, you know, it sounds like you and Murray have and had a really great relationship. And in law school, you're not always told or taught that the relationship between prosecutors and defense attorneys is that good. And I'm wondering what the relationship is generally like between prosecutors and defense attorneys.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I guess I'll say some of what you heard in the Murray episode is very telling and some of it is not. On the one hand, this is fundamentally an adversarial relationship. And this is the part you couldn't really tell on the show. But I mean, we talked about it. Murray and I tried a mob murder case against each other. Murray represented a mob boss. I was one of the prosecutors on the case. And, you know, that's adversarial. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, Murray wasn't a big in-your-face finger wagger, but there were defense lawyers and prosecutors, for that matter, who were. And so it is fundamentally an adversarial relationship. But that said, it's a professional relationship. And it can and ideally should be collegial. And Murray, as you can tell, is somebody who I became very close with. Really more after, you know, the days when I was trying cases and handling cases with him. But, you know, you have to deal with these people all the time, right? In law school, you talk about repeat players or one-time players. I mean, to me, there was always, you know, there are stories of my colleagues getting in physical altercations with defense lawyers, pushing matches, right? I mean, you can Google this stuff, shoving matches, exchanging, you know, nasty words with them in the courthouse. I mean, that was never my style. A, it's just sort of not how I'm wired. B, it just made no sense to me. Why get into a death match with Murray Richman when you're going to have 22 more cases with him the next 5 years? You know what I mean? Also, there is a little bit of like, look, we have this trial together. It's going to take the next 6 weeks. We're all going to go through hell no matter what because it's worked. It's trial. Let's not make it any more difficult on one another than necessary, right? Like, let's be reasonable. Let's agree to stuff. And what ends up happening over time, and again, it's easier once you leave, frankly, is you develop real relationships with people. And I have good relationships like with Murray, like with a lot of defense lawyers now, and a lot of my former prosecutor friends are now defense lawyers. So, but Murray, I think, as you could hear, was a little different, a little something special, I think. You know, I joke with him, my dad's name is Murray. And so I always say Murray Richman is the number two Murray in my life. And whenever he sees me, he always goes, how's Murray number one doing? And, you know, he has a real spark to him and a real sort of humor and passion about what he does and love for life that I really am drawn to. I called him the other day. He called me and I called him back. And it was, you know, 7:30 at night. And of course, I'm 46 years old and I'm getting ready for bed. He's out at a restaurant. I hear wine glasses clanking and he's there with a table full of people. And I'm like, oh, I'll let you go. He's like, no, hey, everybody, I'm on the phone with Ellie Honig. Hey, hey, you know, like that's just Murray. He's a unique personality and probably, you know, sort of a once in a generation type of talent. But I do think that collegiality and cordiality that you heard between Murray and I, it is more common than I think the movies or TV would lead you to believe between prosecutors and defense lawyers.
Well, that is very comforting. And I think that story about Murray being out to dinner just confirms that I might want to be Murray Richmond when I grow up. I don't know.
Absolutely. That's a good goal to have. And by the way, you know, Murray, I forgot about, again, some of these questions you're asking are just triggering memories for me. And I didn't say this on the episode. Murray, one of my very first cases was like a little case with Murray, drug case. And he said to me in the hallway, look, this guy's going to plead. Like, just, you know, we were about to have a pretrial conference. He said, this guy's going to plead. We'll work out the numbers pretty soon. And I said, you know, that was standard. I said, yeah, okay, good. I'll send you a plea agreement when we get back. We go into court that day and Murray's going crazy. Judge, this case is a miscarriage of justice. We're going to move to dismiss. And afterwards I went to him and I was like, what, Murray, what the heck? You know, what was that? And he goes, kid, he goes, just roll with me here. He goes, look, I got to put on a show here for my client. He goes, he's still going to plead. It's in his best interest. Don't worry. But I can't go in there and say, judge, he's ready to plead guilty. I got to put on a little show. Just roll with it. And I was like, okay, good lesson. Good lesson.
I think something that definitely comes across in this episode of how there's so much orchestrating, directing, acting. I don't want to call it manipulating, but there is an art to sort of being in trial mode. And you hear that come through and how Murray prepares, how he acts, even that story.
Yeah, I love that story. I remember him telling me that back when, that he would warm up by singing, right? And I got him to sing in the episode. I asked him to sing and he said no, and then he sang. And you can hear he's got this beautiful, like old-fashioned baritone-y voice. And it's true what I told him. I said, I was kind of jealous of that because he was with his driver. You know, Murray did pretty well in the business. And I'm like on the PATH train walking through this. I can't be singing. One thing that I think Murray really brought to life was the fact that it is a battle of storytelling. It is a show. And I don't mean that in a cynical way, right? It is like putting on a theater production in front of the jury. You have to make sure that you're interesting, that you're compelling, that your visuals make sense, right? And we used to say, like, at a certain point, like, you have to think about this the way almost a theater producer does. Okay, I'm going to say this, then I'm going to show this exhibit by putting it up on the screen, then I'm going to hand the laser pointer to the witness and ask him, you know, if you don't work that stuff out, your message is going to be lost. Now, Murray happened to be masterful at this. And you can imagine, right? I mean, just having listened to the episode, imagine being a juror, right? And imagine this guy with all of his charisma and humor and sort of folksiness, right? I mean, you can see why he was really compelling to a jury.
Absolutely. And as you know, I've been on a jury before. I've had jury duty. And how engaging and enthralling the lawyers can be and how well they can tell their story is a huge part of convincing the jury, even when you know the law and you're supposed to be sort of grounded in the facts. The person marshaling you through them is so important.
Yes, and a really important distinction here that I want to make sure I stress. There is a fundamental difference in the role that a defense lawyer plays and the role that a prosecutor plays. And here's what I mean. So right before my first trial, and I don't write about this particular anecdote in the book, but I write about Rich Sullivan, who was my supervisor, who's now a federal appellate judge and was this sort of master of trial in the Southern District at the time. And the night before I said to him, like, this is a stupid question, but I said, so Rich, what am I supposed to be tomorrow? And he goes, what do you mean? Right? I said, I don't know. Like what? How am I supposed to be in front of the jury? And he said, oh, okay, listen. He goes, leave the hit. You're not there to wow them. You're not there to have them fall in love with you. Your job is to be clear and credible, and that's it. And leave the dramatics and the histrionics and the showmanship to the defense lawyer. And that's good advice. Now, look, over time as a prosecutor, you develop your voice, you find your voice, you find what works for you, and you can do more and sort of bigger stuff. But nobody would ever do the things Murray did, right? Some of the stories he told about, you know, the thing with the sleeping client and all that, right? Like, you would never openly try to crack jokes or bring in props or that kind of thing. Defense lawyers, however, sometimes do that. And it's not because, I mean, maybe it's because they're sort of, you know, just wired a little bit differently, but also they have a different job to do. And I think what they're hoping sometimes is if you can just win them over emotionally, you can maybe win the whole jury or maybe just grab a juror or two and get a hung jury. So it's kind of like the straight man and the, you know, and the comedian or whatever in that context.
That totally makes sense to me. And I am a recovering theater kid as well, which you could probably tell that about me just knowing me as a person.
I think a lot of prosecutors, if you dug back in their background, were theater actors or in singing groups or whatever. I got to say that none of that applies to me.
Well, I think that's why the defense bar appeals so much to me, because you can totally be the character actor, whereas it seems like there is a norm or a culture around prosecution that looks a little more straight man, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. It's really just two different roles in the process.
Well, I love that this episode was so focused on the trial, trial prep, trial strategies. And I loved hearing the singing story that you mentioned. Did you have any prep tactics that you didn't share in this episode or routines?
Well, look, the music thing really resonated with me. And so while I couldn't sing while walking through the streets of Manhattan, I definitely had my headphones on. Like, you know, if you ever see those videos of Kobe or LeBron, you know, or Tom Brady walking into a game with their Beats on. I mean, I didn't have headphones that were that nice, and I probably didn't look nearly as cool as those guys. But I would definitely try to dial in that way. Different people had different ways to deal with it. What, you know what I would do? Gosh, again, I haven't thought about this in years. In fact, when I gave the jury address that Murray talked about, I distinctly remember doing this. So I knew I was no good to sleep the night before a jury address, like maybe 2-3 hours or whatever, but I just physiologically couldn't. And I would just wake up when I was up, and that was like 4 a.m. And I would just go for a run through my neighborhood. Like I would run my normal route, like, you know, 3-4 miles. And I remember doing it in the pitch black in this trial with Murray. And it was like still cold out. In fact, I remember that verdict came back in April. So it was probably March or early April, but it was cold. It was 4 a.m. And I remember a town cop pulled up next to me and said, "Are you okay?" And I didn't quite know what to say. Like, you know, it was a little too long to explain. Like, well, yeah, I'm a prosecutor. I have to give an opening, you know, a closing later today. So I think I just said, "Yeah, I go to work early" or something. And he was like, "All right." But that helped me sort of get out, you know, like exercise helps, I think, with stress.
Well, you mentioned that you put on headphones as you were walking out of the path. I feel like I have to ask you, what's your go-to prep music?
You know, hip hop would do it a lot of times. And I'm like a 90s hip hop guy. You were probably born in the 90s. Uh-huh. But I like the early, well, it wasn't early in his career, but like LL Cool J from around that time, Cypress Hill, you know, groups like that, Warren G., early Dr. Dre, all that stuff. And also, honestly, it's so trite and cliche for me, but Springsteen would do it too, just because it was so uplifting. So there was times when I would listen to that as well.
You're required by the state of New Jersey to say that, right?
I know. And I almost like wish I had something less on point, but that is true.
You mentioned the closing that you gave that Murray was so fond of, that he said was the best closing that he's ever heard. And as you know, I was on the mock trial team at NYU. I'm like obsessed with figuring out the right way to do trials. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that. Do you remember doing it? What made it so good?
Yeah, I remember. Okay, I'm going to give you two things that made it so good. None of them were me per se. One of them is, I always used to say to younger prosecutors, sometimes you're only as cool as your evidence, right? Like, you know, I mean, that happened to be a great case with multiple murders and compelling witnesses and great evidence that backed up what each witness said and just devastating, sensational evidence. And so part of it was just a function of that. And I did other trials where the evidence sucked, or where it was enough for reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt, or the charges were just sort of bland and, you know, loan sharking and who cares. Like, so a lot of times you're only as cool as your evidence. The other big thing is this. The judge made me cut it down the night before the trial. So I was sort of known, or maybe infamous, in the SDNY for working on my jury addresses like for weeks and months in advance. And there were people, by the way, who would write their jury addresses the night before, which I thought was insane. And you can't possibly do it right that way. But I worked on this jury address for literally months. And I had it down to what I thought was going to be this masterpiece. And I remember the judge said the night before closing, he said, "Counsel, who's going to close for the prosecution?" I was like, "Me." He said, "How long are you going to need?" And remember, this is a case that involved 5 murders, murder attempts, or murder conspiracies. 3 defendants, RICO. I mean, like, you know, a large, large case. And I very proudly said, "Judge, I'm going to be able to do this closing tomorrow in under 3 hours." And the judge literally threw his papers in the air. Like, there were papers that got air. And he went, "You got to be kidding me. You have 90 minutes. And I remember going back to the trial room that I talked about before with my trial partners and going like, "I don't know what to do. I have to cut this in half." And they were like freaked out too. And I just sat there that night and I just cut, you know, and it hurt. But, you know, it's, as we say in the writing business, you have to drown your kitten sometimes, right? And I cut it down to 90 minutes and it was so concise and it was so action-packed. There was no dead time. There was no spinning of wheels. And it was just like a 90-minute, you know, it's the difference between, if you could take a 3-hour movie and cut it down to 90 minutes, you know, it would be, and you could keep the storyline, it would be riveting and it would be sort of action-packed. And for that reason, because I was forced to cut it down, I think it ended up being really compelling.
The power of good editing is definitely something that I think law school taught me. I feel like I used to be so verbose and all of my edits back were just like cut. And it really forces you to focus on the things that matter.
And this varies, by the way, by prosecutor's offices, because you'll see things out there, you'll hear people say, or you'll read stories about, "Oh, the prosecutor delivered a 3-day opening," or "the prosecutor gave a, yes, you know, a 19-hour closing and he had a witness on the stand for 2.5 days. That makes me cringe so hard. And I was already, by the way, with this 3-hour closing, I was already like known in the office for being on the extreme side of brevity, I used to tell my people, if you can't open in 20 minutes, then you're not doing it right. If you can't, but I mean, I figured in a 3-defendant, 5-murder case and other, a whole bunch of other extortions and stuff, like 3 hours is that didn't feel like it was much to me. But you know what? You almost never feel like, well, that was too short, right? So I'm a big, and now that I do media, I'm even more of a proponent of that.
Well, I think it feels like one thing to sort of plan and do a trial for someone else. But I was shocked in this episode to hear about Murray defending himself when he faced criminal charges. And I wondered if you were ever, knock on wood, God forbid, faced with any kind of criminal charge or even a civil charge, would you ever defend yourself?
No, I would hire Murray Richmond. No. No, absolutely not. I was actually surprised. I think you can maybe hear it in the episode. I didn't know. I knew he had been indicted and tried, which, by the way, is insane, right? The fact that, like, the guy got indicted by the SDNY and then tried and then, and I mean, but I was a little surprised when he said he defended himself because, you know, there's the old axiom about any lawyer who defends himself has an idiot for a client or something to that effect. But, and I said to him in the episode, I think I said, "So you stood in front of the jury and said, I didn't do it, or, you know, I am not guilty because of this or that." And he's like, "Yeah, it was much more effective that way." I mean, I don't know. I get, you know, I guess so. My instinctive answer is no, I would definitely hire somebody, but I don't know. I guess a part of me thinks like it's more compelling if they get to know you, especially if they kind of like you. Right. And the other thing is like, I'm pretty demanding and critical of what lawyers do. And so I would probably be going crazy if I felt like my lawyer wasn't performing up to my standard. So I'm pretty sure that I would go hire somebody, but I'm also pretty sure it would be one of my former SDNY colleagues. So, you know, that's where I would come out on it, I think.
It reminded me of when I did student government in undergrad, I was brought to like a fake criminal. It was a real trial for election fraud, which I was totally innocent of. And they gave me like a school appointed lawyer to defend against the charges I had run for student government.
Okay.
And I told him like, "It's your case, man. Like, you got this, you do it." I was, you know, a senior in college. And as he was taking, you know, he was cross-examining witnesses, directing witnesses, I literally took the notes out of his hand and was like, "Sit down. I got to do this myself."
So hold on a second. So you're like, you like Murray were charged officially?
I was charged with like violating. The other party at school charged everyone who they thought was going to win.
Oh my
I was
God.
The only person that won. And I thought I was capable of handing it over to a lawyer to defend me, but I had to take over because I just couldn't help it.
What were you acquitted like Murray?
I was totally acquitted. All right, good. It was like a headline for one day and then everyone moved on.
Wow, I had no idea. But yeah, I think I'd be the same way. I'd be like, "Give me those notes, sit down, I'm doing this." Yeah. Wow, you were acquitted. I was going to say such a lawbreaker, but I'm glad that you were vindicated.
Thank you. Yeah, it was like the biggest thing in the world because everything at college is the biggest thing in the world when it's happening to you.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I think we should end on something that Murray talked about at the end of the episode. You asked him about his losing faith in the system. You know, he talks about growing up in New York and wanting to be a lawyer and pulling himself up by his bootstraps and working in the system, but then over time, losing faith in it. And I'm wondering, after your time in it, how do you feel?
Murray's answer surprised me there. And I think that comes through in the episode, because I think if you talk to most people, especially, you know, guys who have been doing this for 50 years and are most normal people of Murray's age are retired. He's partially retired, but I think usually you get the opposite. I think you get the rose colored glasses and you get the, you know, look, our system's not perfect, but it's the best system known to man and, you know, all of that. But he really sort of came out on the opposite side. And if anything, it sounds like he became more disenchanted later. I'm much more on the idealistic side or the hopeful side. I do think our system works, not perfectly. No one would ever say that, but about as well as any human system could work. I fundamentally disagree with Murray on some of the things he said, and we talked about this in the episode, right? This idea that cooperators just go up there and lie all the time, and we know it. I mean, that's just completely not true. And if it was true, he'd be justified in his belief. And he believes it is true. And he can feel that way. That's fine. But I don't feel that way because I've been on this side and I've known that. So I'm much less jaded about it than Murray is. But look, he certainly has earned the right to have his own views. I mean, nobody's got more of a body of experience, maybe in the whole country right now, than Murray Richmond. So I always respect what he says. And I always find what he says inspiring and interesting and thought-provoking.
Definitely. And one sort of follow-up to that is he says that defense attorneys consider themselves liberty's last champion. And I wondered, in that framing, what does that make the prosecutor? Who's champion and where does that sort of put you in the system?
Yeah. And by the way, I liked when Murray said that. I thought that was well put. And I guess, you know, one could roll their eyes at that, but I don't. I think it's an apt description of what Murray does and what defense lawyers do. And even if your client's as guilty as his, you know, mob boss who I convicted of murder, you still have a role to play in protecting their liberty and their constitutional rights. What would that make me? I don't know. Any prosecutor. I guess you would say justice's champion, right? At the risk of sounding equally corny and sort of high-handed. But, you know, prosecutors seek justice and defense lawyers protect constitutional liberties. And I think that's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, I think we can end on a corny note then, because it was nice hearing justice and liberty and both of those perspectives in this episode, and that both of those sides of the coin can be friends. I think that came through in this episode and was a really great explanation of how the system works.
And what I love about Murray is, you know, we can talk high-handed, we can talk about principles and theories, but everything for him is based on things that he did on the streets, in the courthouses, in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, in Manhattan. And so he's sort of earned all of that.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Ellie. This has been the second bonus episode of Up Against the Mob, and we will see you next week.
That's it for this episode of Up Against the Mob. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners to find the show. And as always, please send us your thoughts or questions to letters@cafe.com. Up Against the Mob is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ellie Honig. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tadashur. Music is by Nat Wiener. The Cafe team is Matt Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, and Jake Kaplan. Special thanks to Nate White for his help with research. And special thanks to my interviewer, Safina Mekli. I'm Ellie Honig, and this is Up Against the Mob.